We'll hear the story behind Thomas Hood in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the suburban Chicago studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Larry McGlure, KB9DIP, with the February 24th rain report. If you have been following solar propagation reports over the years, you probably have read propagation columns from Thomas Hood, NW7US. Thomas has been featured a few times on these rain report hamcasts. However, this is the first time we have featured him telling his story. Here's the first of two excerpts from an hour-long conversation between Thomas and Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, of QSO Today.
I was a young boy living in Montana, and my parents gave us more or less free rein when we're not in school. And being a very curious boy, I would go through the house looking for things of interesting playability, things that I could invent imaginative scenarios. I would rummage through my dad's belongings and discovered cameras and a radio. I secreted the radio away down a few houses from where we lived, went underneath the porch, and began trying to figure out what this radio did. And I figured out how to turn it on, and I began turning knobs, extending the antenna. Man, the exotic sounds that came out of this one segment of the radio when I switched this knob to something called SW, I was fascinated. There were weird sounds coming out of this thing. And then I came across this monotone clicking. And all of a sudden I heard,
"This is radio station WWB, Fort Collins, Colorado."
And gave the time.
At the tone, 16 hours, 30 minutes. Coordinated universal time.
Why would anybody tell me the time on a radio and click out the seconds? It was obvious that these clicks were seconds being ticked away. So I would just sit there and listen and listen and listen, kind of going off into dreamland a little bit. And then somebody came on and said,
"Solar flux 87, estimated planetary index 11. The estimated planetary index at 2100 UTC on 21st August was total."
How many sunspots there were, and that we had a geomagnetic storm, which I had no clue what any of that meant. But that was the spark for a lifelong curiosity about our sun and about whatever it was that these people were talking about on this little radio underneath the porch in Montana. And as I continued to experiment day after day during the summer, I heard, "This is Radio South Africa. This is the BBC. This is the Voice of America. Radio Australia. Deutsche Welle." I was like, wow, people talking from all over the world. How could that work?
Did you have to come out from under the porch at some point and confront your father that you'd found a radio?
No, I never told them for quite a while. Over the years, the one that I had as a child disappeared somewhere. But when I was at this ham fest, I came across the same exact radio. It's basically a Sony 4-band portable radio. Horrible receiver. But at the time, I didn't have any clue as to what was good or bad. It was just what it was. I posted that on Facebook, and my dad, who's also on Facebook, saw that and he goes, "Hey, that's the radio I bought when I was in Germany all the time in my car because it was able to be mounted in a vehicle." And I said, "Yeah, that was the first radio that I ever used, and it got me started with outside of the computer side of things. It's what I do with my life." And he goes, "Yeah, I always wondered what happened to that. It disappeared." Well, it's because I stole it. So it was after, you know, so many years. That was in the 1970s, early 70s, that I secreted that radio away. And speaking of that, like I told you, I was always curious. I would take a lot of my dad's belongings, even alarm clocks, and I would disassemble them and then try to put them back together again because I wanted to figure out how they worked. And then I put them back together. Usually, I could put the thing back together and it'll all be fine and worked. But alarm clocks, once in a while, I had extra little things laying around. And then they didn't have an alarm clock that worked. We'd go out and get another one, take that apart. I got in trouble a lot because of that. In Missoula, we lived on a military base. It's called Fort Missoula. 70s, there was a Navy reserve unit that had this long building that interior was redesigned as a simulated ship. They had an engine room and all sorts of different parts of a ship. of course, that was fascinating to me as a young boy. So I would go in there and I would watch them do their drills and I would just observe mostly. But when they weren't there and drilling, I the building and I was looking at things like the telephone wires that came in and I would pull that. Of course, their phones never worked, and they were trying to figure out why. It's because I was playing around with this stuff. And I got, like I said, in huge trouble. But my mind was so active and so curious about the scientific side of things, wires, electricity. Yes, I was the boy that stuck things into an outlet and went boom with the electrical arc between two things. Got myself shocked. Assembling anything electronic and trying to put it back together. My dad caught on. And to bring home these Radio Shack 150-in-1 project springs, and you wire things together, and they had the resistors and the transistors and a meter and a speaker and a Morse code key that was just basically bent metal with a little plastic knob on it. He brought books home and fed my curiosity. And that was the start in radio.
So how did you find your way into amateur radio?
Well, I continued to beg information. We were at church and I had a book on tubes listening to the sermon. I wasn't paying attention to the ethereal. I was in this book reading about tubes and how they worked. And I had a little sketch pad and I was drawing a tube diagram and I was just trying to copy and absorb all this information. And I guess there was somebody in the pew behind me who was an amateur radio operator, but he didn't come directly to me. He took my dad aside privately. Your son will knack for electronics. I'm an amateur radio operator, and I'd like to give you information, some books and materials that you can give him to continue his. That was my first introduction to amateur radio, indirectly through this connection. I'm not sure why the guy didn't talk directly to me. Maybe my dad said no or something. I don't know. I have a clue. But that was my first exposure. But then there was no amateur radio exposure for a very long time. From the kid perspective, I think it was about 4 or 5 years later, we had moved from Montana down to Salt Lake City. My dad was restationed by the U.S. Army to an installation in Salt Lake City. It was in Salt Lake City that I came across this huge tower, a big antenna. And I went, radio, I know what that is. So I went over there and I boldly knocked on the door. I said, you have a big antenna. Do you do radio? And that was where I first began to get Elmered directly on a radio. He gave me Amico records where I would go and listen to 2 words a minute, 5 words a minute. And I slowly began to learn Morse code the wrong way, I think now. But there was to me by my first Elmer. Tom Billis, maybe. I have no clue what his call was. He's a silent key. I think it was in the 90s that I discovered that he had passed away. This, I think, was about 76 or 77.
So what year did you get your first license and how old were you?
Well, there's the journey. See, I got Elmered and I learned Morse code. But because I was a military brat, we started doing a lot more moving around. In Montana, I stayed there a good stint because my dad was able to convince the Army to let him stay there as long as possible because he just absolutely loved Montana. But then the military started moving us around. So after Salt Lake City, we moved back to Montana for a very short period, and then we moved up to Alaska. This first Elmer of mine, though, did give me my second shortwave receiver. It was made by Collins, an interesting radio. I'm trying to remember the nomenclature specifically. I'll have to go look at where I can find that. But it was the most amazing radio. It dwarfed anything that portable radio could hear. So when we moved from Salt Lake, a short stint in Montana, then we went up to Alaska. Well, in Alaska, I erected a wire antenna around my bedroom along the walls with the darkness of winter almost all of the day and ounce of time just absorbing of shortwave from one end to the other, and even AM DXing. I heard stations during the nighttime with that makeshift antenna.
You're listening to the first of two excerpts from an interview Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, conducted for his QSO Today podcast with Thomas Hood, NW7US. Known worldwide for his propagation columns, he's written for various shortwave and ham publications. We'll conclude this first excerpt from this interview after I remind you that Rain Report updates Saturdays on www.therainreport.com. It's also heard as part of the amateur radio block of programming Saturday evenings on WTWW shortwave on 5085 kHz. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So, from Salt Lake up to Montana to Alaska, and then Alaska back to Montana. School, just graduating, is a real quick story. I went into own business. I was an entrepreneur. I went into satellite TV, sold satellite TVs, and I also did computer stuff. Because along the way, my dad became a computer salesman, bought home computers, and I started learning computers. So that was a natural thing for me to do, is become this business person, started a business, had clients, did programming, and installed satellite TV. I got a partner. The partner embezzled. All of a sudden, I got sued. My lawyer said, you know the best thing for you right now? Let me handle exonerating you in court, but you should probably join the Army and just get the heck out of Montana. Because at that point, we had come back to Montana. And I said, join the Army with his life. I don't know if I want to do that. Well, I talked with my dad, and he convinced me, yeah, it's a good idea. You should do it. You get this college fund and all that. So I joined the Army, and I went into the Signal Corps. I was a signal man, and I did shortwave stuff, and I did satellite stuff in the Army. So that childhood experience, radio, and learning about propagation, because I got books on propagation in the ionosphere, all of that lent itself to being a signal man in the Army. Amazing things while I was in the Army because of my knowledge. When I got out of the Army in Connecticut, I worked at the Travelers as a programmer, and my supervisor was a ham radio operator. So he was my second ham radio Elmer. To relearn the code, and he and some other ham radio operator eventually gave me a novice test in the cafeteria, Morse code, and I had to receive Morse code to their satisfaction, and I got my novice license. And that was 1990.
And what was your call sign?
KA1VGL. KA1, very good lasagna. I stayed at the Travelers for about a year. This is a negative, but I got custody of the kids. Had no interest in, at that time, being a mother. So I ended up with kids, and I was working at the Travelers. They allowed me to telecommute for a bit, but it was just too difficult with basically an infant and a toddler to work all day and have two kids and being somewhat a new dad. My dad back in Montana, who had retired in Montana, and my mom there said, well, why don't you come back to Montana and we'll help you raise the kids? And I thought that was a pretty good prospect. So I gave my notice at the Travelers, gear and other belongings, and drove to Montana. When I got to Montana, this is a prime time for me to get a new call sign. And since it was a regulation that when you move into a new region, you had to refile anyway, the FCC assigned me N7PMS. Horrible call sign for a guy, especially once I got to 80 meters. Check in to these nightly round tables. I give my call N7PMS. And man, it would be 5 to 10 minutes of ribbing. But I chose different phonetics than what people think of PMS. Montana skunk. So that's what I pushed anytime people were ribbing me of PMS.
So you're new in Montana. Did you get a rig at that point?
I was still using the Kenwood 520S as my first rig. By the way, that was given to me by my second Elmer at the Travelers. He wanted to inspire me and get air. So he said, hey, I've got this old Kenwood TS520S. I'm going to give that to you as your first rig and as my gift that you passed your novice test and get on the air and operate. Let me build my first antenna, which was a random length of wire and a ground. And it was a Dentron tuner, which was about the size of two shoe boxes. Amazing Dentron manual tuner.
Didn't that have a roller inductor inside?
Yeah.
I don't think you see those very much anymore. A lot of tuners have fixed points on the coils.
I think they don't make things the way they used to. There was some really great construction in some of those older companies like Dentron. Long story short, after Montana, I moved to Washington State to find better opportunity for work. That did help as a single dad. I was a single dad for 11 years, so I was raising those boys by myself. And ham radio still played a huge role for me. And I, through the years, upgraded until I got to Amateur Extra. And I had 520S. I went to a Kenwood 830, I think it was. an 830, which was a really nice radio. It had the WARC work bands, which like 30 meters and of those. So I got more spectrum and enjoyed, I began learning about 30 meters and what it was capable of. And I did a lot of ham radio stuff in Washington State, the Evergreen State. That's where, when I upgraded to Amateur Extra, I applied for a vanity call for the NW7US to get away from that PMS call. And I chose NW7US because I am a huge fan of the Pacific Northwest and Montana. Montana is not considered the Pacific Northwest, but it's adjacent to it. So in my mind, anything Northwest United States is just beautiful. And so I wanted to promote that love by getting a call sign NW7US. And there were no NW7 prefixes taken by anybody. And even though I could have gone with a 1x2 call sign, I chose the 2x2 call sign because I wanted to promote the Northwest 7 United States. I had this really excellent friend, Mitch. NA7US is a call sign that he applied for after he saw my call sign. He went, "Hey, I like that idea." So he got North America 7US.
Do you think that hams still enjoy shortwave listening? And do you think that it would make us better operators if we listened more?
Oh, that's key. Great that you brought that up. There are a lot of people that don't listen well. I believe, in my case, that the extensive hours that I listened to shortwave, and I listened to air traffic, I listened to mariners, I listened to military operations, and of course I listened to a lot of ham radio, both Morse code and voice. And I gained a sense of more than just an etiquette, but a skill in communicating well the message that you're trying to convey.
What I've heard from a number of operators, they say that if you spend enough time listening to a pileup, for example, in a contest, you start to figure out what the receiving station is doing. I mean, where the guy that's actually running the pileup, you kind of get a sense of where he's going to show up or where he's listening.
Absolutely.
And in that sense,
that's a lost skill.
Right. In that sense, that was kind of the point of my question. But if we're listening more, then we kind of figure out what people are doing.
Oh, I love the DXing hunt and pileups. I was a new ham, still living in Connecticut. And code, it's a little bit different than voice, but the same criteria of the hunt exists. You've got to listen carefully to find his modus operandi. What is that operator doing? How does he work that split? Does he go up? Does he go down? Does he stay on a single frequency for a bit? What's his rhythm? And what's the rhythm of the pileup? Because I think a pileup begins to have its own rhythm. And if you can figure that out by listening for a while, and that's the trick too, because it may not be a long opening. So you got to get in there before the opening closes if conditions are marginal. But if you've got a good knack for listening to the rhythm of things, you'll find that opening. And man, I loved with 100 watts and a random piece of wire, I broke so many pileups. And I think that ability to break pileups, like the first or second call, I would be able to work the DX in really heavy pileups with 100 watts in a simple piece of wire. And again, I think the long time of listening to shortwave, the years before that, I just had the knack to hear that rhythm and find out where that opening was, where I could insert myself between the two beats, everybody calling and the guy moving just a little bit in frequency. So yes, the answer is absolutely learning how to listen, to grasp the rhythm of the pileup or whatever your environment is giving you out to success, in my opinion. It's not the huge antenna and the kilowatts and calling over and over and over and over and over and hoping that eventually something sticks to the wall. I mean, that's brute force, but I think the art and skill of DXing.
The thoughts of propagation columnist Thomas Hood, NW7US, shared with QSO Today's Eric Guth for Z1UG. We'll bring you our second and final excerpt from their conversation next time. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2018. Rain. All rights are reserved. I'm Larry McGlure, KB9DIP, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. www.therainreport.com. TedRandall.com. Heard at 9 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time, Saturdays, on Ted Randall's QSO program on WTWW Shortwave from Lebanon, Tennessee, on 5085 kilohertz. Keep on hamming.